Englishmen wondered what kind of nation drove its best minds into exile. As the Samson and its 100 passengers made ready to leave the harbor at Gravesend on April 7, 1794, a few friends and admirers sadly said goodbye. Joseph was given a silver inkstand with the inscription, "To Joseph Priestley, LLD, on his departure into exile," from a few members of the University of Cambridge who regret that expression of their esteem should be occasioned by the ingratitude of their country. The Society of United Irishmen of Dublin, no lovers of Mother England, envisioned a scientific future of war and devastation and bemoaned a world where all the arts and sciences are put under a state of requisition, when the attention of a whole scientific people is bent to multiplying the means and instruments of destruction, and when philosophy rises in a mass to drive on the wedge of war. A black powder has changed the military art, and in a great degree the manners of mankind. Why may not the same science which produced it produce another powder, which, inflamed under a certain compression, might impel the air so as to shake down the strongest towers and scatter destruction? But he was going to a better place, a country where science is turned to better uses and where thousands of Irish had fled. They hoped that all would find peace on that far shore. Priestley was hoping for more than just peace. He hoped to create with his sons an ideological utopia. Many exiles from the ruins of the Enlightenment had set their eyes on the New World as the only great nursery of free men left upon the face of the earth, an asylum for the friends of liberty. When Priestley sailed, the hope of founding a utopia had progressed farther than just a pipe dream. Soon after the Samson departed, a correspondent for the Gentleman's Magazine reported that Priestley, his sons, and a mutual friend have contracted for a large quantity of land, estimated at 300,000 acres, in Northumberland and Luzerne counties in the state of Pennsylvania, about 120 miles from Philadelphia, situated on the West Branch, north of the Susquehanna River. Words from the study A World on Fire by Joe Jackson, centering on the life and times of Joseph Priestley, described as a firebrand who kept company with Ben Franklin, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson, to whose new nation he eventually fled from England, only to settle here in our area. And it is this part of the story we'll experience in a brand new play. Gunpowder Joe, Joseph Priestley, Pennsylvania, and the American Experiment. That is a world premiere play by the award-winning playwright Anthony Clairvaux, commissioned by and created with the Bloomsburg Theatre Ensemble, about Joseph Priestley, celebrated scientist, radical religious leader, and fierce defender of the American Revolution, who, after making himself the most hated man in England, spent his last years here in Northumberland. Gunpowder Joe is directed by ensemble member Laurie McCants, and she paid a visit to the WVIA studio at the Community Arts Center in Williamsport to speak with Fiona Powell about the play and Joseph Priestley.
Gunpowder Joe is Joseph Priestley, who was a famous 18th century scientist, theologian, political philosopher, and radical, who ended up spending the last 10 years of his life in our neighborhood in Northumberland, Pennsylvania, because he had been basically booted out of England due to his radical beliefs, both his religious beliefs and his political beliefs. And his enemies in England gave him that nickname, Gunpowder Joe. He admits it was a mistake. In one of his sermons, he expressed his desire for the monarchy and the Church of England to be basically exploded with gunpowder, because he was a great supporter of the American Revolution, friends with our founders, and he really believed that a new era was at hand in which all of the monarchies would fall and he was a great believer in democracy. But his enemies had called him Gunpowder Joe, and we titled our play that because, well, people will wonder. Playwright is Anthony Clairvaux. He is a well-produced, well-published playwright, and BTE has done 3 of his plays before this one. The first one we did was Ambition Facing West, but I actually met Anthony even before that. I had been given a job as an actor in a new play festival at Carnegie Mellon back in the early 90s, and I was cast in his play The Living, which is a play about the plague year in London, and it was because of his writing in The Living that I knew that he would be a good playwright for illuminating Joseph Priestley's life here in Pennsylvania, because he's very, very good at taking historical material, remaining true to the history, but making it sound very contemporary and very lively. He and I have been researching for, 6 years now, and I'm just in awe of how he's taken some, you know, rather thorny material in terms of a very tricky time, particularly in American history, and verbiage that is a little more ornate than what we usually engage in. He's taken that and distilled it to a very compelling play and quite understandable and accessible for modern audiences.
Joseph Priestley, famous in the British Isles, famous in the United States, particularly in Pennsylvania. Aren't there a ton of plays already written about Priestley?
Not that I'm aware of. I know of one. It's called O2, and it's written by Carl Gerassi, who is a scientist. He is actually the inventor of the birth control pill, which is where he made his money, and now he is a theater person. And he and someone else, whose name I can't remember, created a play about Joseph Priestley, The Discovery of Oxygen, which is the discovery that Priestley is most famous for, and the fact that almost at the same time, the French chemist Lavoisier also discovered oxygen. There was a famous dinner party in which Priestley told Lavoisier about his discovery, and then, oh my gosh, just a little while later, Lavoisier made the same discovery. Lavoisier was the one who called it oxygen. Priestley clung to his really awkward name for O2. His name was dephlogisticated air, for complicated old-fashioned chemistry reasons that we don't need to go into now, but it was oxygen.
Priestley is such a complicated person, though. He led a very complicated and involved life and knew a lot of people. How on earth do you, the pair of you doing the research, decide how to distill that into one story?
Well, yeah, that was the trick. The more we got to know about Priestley, the harder it was to narrow down, because he was a man of so many accomplishments and famous in so many fields. We could have done a play completely about his scientific discoveries. We could have done a play about his religious philosophy, which was radical at the time. He was a Unitarian minister, a very serious thinker in the field of theology. We could have done a play about his educational reforms. He was one of the first people to actually create a grammar book for teaching English, the English language. He was an innovator in that field. He was friends of our founders in the United States. In fact, Thomas Jefferson credits Priestley with some of the phrases in the Declaration of Independence. You know, when we started finding out that Priestley had nurtured these friendships through letters and then was invited by his friends to come and settle in the States after he had basically been booted out of England, we thought, well, we should do a play about the time he was here in Pennsylvania. And what a time it was! That was the best choice ever, because Priestley, being the kind of guy he was, thought that he was going to spend his later life in retirement in his beautiful house that his wife had designed on the banks of the Susquehanna, continuing his chemical experiments, which he did. In fact, he discovered carbon monoxide in Northumberland, lived to tell the tale. But he was a political creature. His friends were Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. He got completely embroiled in the furious debate between the two of them about the shape and power of our fledgling nation. This is the time when John Adams became president, Thomas Jefferson was his vice president because he came in second. The two of them were dear, dear friends personally and bitter enemies politically. John Adams was a Federalist. Thomas Jefferson's newly emerging party was dubbed the Democrat Republicans. They were completely divided as to what the shape of our government should be. Adams and the Federalists believed it should be a strong central government. Jefferson felt that it should be more agricultural, less industrial, less global, more state rights, smaller government. And Adams and Jefferson were incredibly passionate and articulate spokespersons for each of their points of view. Each of them wanted Priestley on their side because Priestley was famous. Priestley was paid attention to. Priestley ended up siding with Jefferson, which made him almost an enemy of the state. The Adams administration, in the time period of the play, created the notorious Alien and Sedition Acts. The Alien Act was to protect the new country, America, from alien influences. Of course, the French Revolution was raging at the time, and there was a fear, a legitimate fear, that French spies were going to try the same thing in our country that they were doing in France. And the sedition law made it actually against the law to criticize the president in print. So freedom of press was taken away. Priestley came under fire. And if it had not been for the long, deep friendship between Adams and Priestley, he would have been deported. This was an amazing American story that we discovered in doing the research on the play, and that is what the play is about.
Poor Priestley, he's an enemy of the state in mm-hmm. his own Britain, mm-hmm. comes over here and expects a smooth ride and becomes enemy of the state over here.
Well, in some ways, he just couldn't help himself. He was passionate in his beliefs, and he could not help writing about them, and that would continually get him in trouble.
It's very interesting that you're using that part of his life because it's a part of his life that we don't know very much about.
And it's the part that he spent here in our neighborhood.
From the characters in the play, you have the greats. You obviously have Joseph Priestley and John Adams. You have Thomas Jefferson. It's delightful to see you have some very strong female characters. Can
yes,
you talk
we do.
About them?
Yes, well, Abigail Adams, of course. John and Abigail are probably most famous as a couple. It was, in many ways, a glorious marriage. Both of them so respectful of each other. Abigail was invaluable to John in so many ways, in leading the country and also just as a partner. It's a glorious partnership, and it's so wonderful to see that brought to life in the play. Abigail was also very protective of her husband and wanted to protect him from what she perceived as enemy forces. And, you know, unfortunately for Priestley, for a while, she perceived Priestley as an enemy. In the long run, you know, the friendship lasted. We also have Mary Priestley, who, again, was a wonderful partner for Joseph. He credited her managing of his life so that he could be free to do his experimenting and write his political treatises. She managed the household. She was also, again, a complete intellectual partner. He always tried out all of his writings with her. The story is that they played chess every night of their marriage, and more often than not, Mary won. He really relied on her, loved her deeply, and of course she came with him to America, designed the beautiful house that is still on the banks of the Susquehanna in Northumberland, preserved beautifully by the friends of the Joseph Priestley House. Unfortunately, Mary never got to live in that house because she died before the house was finished. But she did come over with him here, and she is buried in Northumberland.
And you introduce us to Sally Hemings.
Sally Hemings, yes. Well, when Anthony decided that he was going to structure the play as a series of domestic intimate scenes between duos, you have the duo of Joseph and Mary Priestley, the duo of John and Abigail Adams, and then you've got Thomas Jefferson. And his partner really was Sally Hemings. His wife had died early on, and Sally, who was an enslaved young woman, owned by Jefferson, became his lifelong partner. Their relationship lasted almost 40 years. It was rumored at the time that it was happening. It has now been pretty much thoroughly established by DNA testing. Almost all of the scholars agree that this was indeed a relationship. They had several children. Anthony had to more or less create Sally's voice from his own imagination and from the very little that we know about Sally, because there are no diaries, there are no letters, nothing of her own actual voice remains. But we know that it was a significant relationship, and so she is also present in the play. And her presence is very important to the play, because the overall theme, the overall question that the play raises is America as an experiment. What is this nation? What was this nation at its founding? What is this nation now? And in telling that story and looking at that question, race is a necessary ingredient, an absolutely necessary ingredient.
You introduce us to other notable characters, notable politicians and thinkers of the day, many of whom we won't have heard of before.
Well, John Adams' Secretary of State was Timothy Pickering, and he was extremely influential. He was, again, very protective of John Adams and very protective of the politics represented by the Adams administration. He was very influential, and as we found out in our research, he was the one who really wanted Priestley deported, because he believed that Priestley was an enemy of the state. So as it turns out, he's something of the villain of the piece, but he is very clever and he is very, very political in his manipulations. He is played in our play by Elizabeth Dowd, who is doubling as Mary Priestley. And Elizabeth is doing a splendid job. I'm sure that many of your listeners are familiar with the television drama House of Cards, both the British version and the American version. That kind of political manipulation that you see in that program, that's exactly what was going on in the early years of our American nation. And Pickering was vital to those manipulations.
Why did you choose to have Elizabeth playing Timothy Pickering?
Well, it's partly just size of our ensemble and the need for doubling. The style of the show is very much like many of the plays that we do at BTE, where there's a lot of completely out front doubling of actors playing multiple roles. The other really fun doubling is a guest artist, Jubalith Moore, is taking on the role of Abigail Adams. She is also playing the role of prickly, notorious, famous journalist William Cobbett, known better by his pen name, Peter Porcupine. The Peter Porcupine Gazette was a very famous newspaper coming out of Philadelphia. Philadelphia was our nation's capital at this time. Peter Porcupine was the political journalist arm for the Federalists. Newspapers at the time, as they do now, had political bents, and they were supported by the then emerging parties. Peter Porcupine was the favorite journalist of the Adamses and of the Federalists. He was a sworn enemy of Joseph Priestley, and that enmity had started back in England, actually, because Peter Porcupine was actually British, over here to make a buck and make his way in the new nation. The other journalist, again, I said Anthony has structured the play as a play between duos. Peter Porcupine's duo partner is the sparring journalist Benjamin Franklin Beach. Benjamin Franklin Beach was Benjamin Franklin's grandson. He inherited the printing press and the publishing business from his grandfather. His newspaper was called the Aurora, and his newspaper was favored by the Jeffersonians, by the Democrat Republicans.
We think in terms of embracing a role and completely taking it on board, and that must be then difficult if within the same production you've got to embrace two.
The play moves very swiftly from scene to scene to scene. There are musical transitions and there's movement in the transitions. The actors have a split second to doff a gown and don a jacket, which is what they do. that all happens right in front of the audience. The audience will see it happening. The clothing helps, because the clothing helps you define your posture and your carriage and so on. But I will say that both Elizabeth and Jubilife have also created physically and almost spiritually completely different characters. Mary Priestley is very straightforward, very witty, very supportive of her husband, but also challenging. Same with Abigail Adams. Both actors are carrying a sort of female presence that is informed by the time period. When they switch to their male characters, their voices drop about an octave. They carry themselves completely differently. Elizabeth's character, Pickering, sort of cuts through the world like a razor blade. Peter Porcupine is very prickly and funny. Jubilith has managed to create a vocal and physical equivalent of the incredible political cartoons that appeared during the time period. Cartoons making fun of Priestley, making fun of Jefferson, making fun of Adams. Political cartooning is nothing new either.
Can you talk a little bit about music? You alluded to music a moment ago, so I now suspect that music is going to be very much part of this.
Yes, music is throughout the piece. Early on, we brought on board a composer and musician who grew up in Bloomsburg, Steve Gilliland. He's an amazing musician. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He's a member of several different bands in our area. He writes his own music as well. I knew that I wanted a real contemporary sound, even though what I did was I gave him 18th century tunes. And I said, so Steve, here are the tunes that I want you to use, but I want you to do your thing with them. Steve is famous in our area also as a one-man band. He does what a lot of musicians are doing these days, beatboxing, live looping, so that he lays down tracks live and plays along with himself, sings along with himself. It's a very contemporary sound. It's a sound that young people recognize and dance to. It's a sound that they're going to be hearing in this show. Steve is right on stage with us with his keyboard, with his computer. He is playing guitar, both electric and acoustic. He's also playing mandolin. He's also using a variety of percussive instruments. He'll lay down the loops and clap and do beatboxing. But the tunes that he's using, I gave him two tunes by early American composer William Billings, one of which is a very famous tune for the American Revolutionary period, and another is a beautiful hymn. Also, I've given him some folk music from the time period. So he's using historical material, but giving it a real contemporary sound, which is exactly the style of the play. It's an up-to-date story. I wanted to honor the historical time period was a time that's famous for innovation, for technological innovation. Of course, Priestley himself was an inventor and a discoverer and an explorer and an experimenter. He was fully participating in what we call the Age of Enlightenment, in which people like Jefferson, like Benjamin Franklin, were experimenting, discovering, creating, looking at the world as a place to explore and discover. That is a tradition that is to be honored and to be carried on. So in our presentation of the play, we are honoring that tradition by following the path that has been laid down for us by these explorers, inventors, discoverers before us. Of course, Priestley was Benjamin Franklin's protege. Priestley is the reason why we know the story about the key and the kite. Priestley wrote that story. Priestley wrote one of the first big books about electricity called The History of Electricity and Its Present State. That remained the textbook for electricity for many decades following its publication. So Priestley was doing a lot of experiments with electricity with his protege, Franklin. And one of the wonderful things about our presentation and how our play looks on the stage is that we have a great partnership with Bucknell University in making this play happen. And a Bucknell University engineering student, Eli Raker Jordan, has been spending the last few months building a replica of Priestley's static electricity machine. It's gorgeous. It's on the stage. It is being used as a demonstration. That's what they were doing in the 18th century. What we're doing now is putting electronic music on stage. And projections. There's a gorgeous projection design that will help the audience understand who these famous people are, what these famous events are, where we are, and where these events are happening. It's going to be a thrilling piece. I know that some folks will think, oh, this is going to be a historical drama. Well, it is dramatic, and the history is fascinating, but what's going to be so surprising is how lively, electric, exciting, thrilling this play is, and really how up-to-date it is. The questions that are encountered in a deep and passionate way in this play are exactly the same questions we are facing right now in this election year. What is America? What is democracy? How do we proceed? How do we move forward? What did our founders mean? How do we follow in their path? How do we make it our own? Those are exactly the questions that we are facing. And there's music, there's incredible movement that's just, it's so engaging, that's been created by our choreographer, Kelly Knox, who's from Bucknell University. Costumes are designed by Paula Davis from Bucknell University. The set is designed by Elaine Williams from Bucknell University. And Elaine took a trip with me to Monticello this past summer, so we were inspired by that incredible architecture and that beautiful furniture. The whole piece is a beautiful blend of history and right now.
What sort of age range is Gunpowder Joe aimed at? Is this a play that you could bring your child, grandchild to, and about what age?
Yeah, I would say from about 10 up. It's very easy to follow. It's very lively, as I said. It will be tremendously engaging. And we are blessed by the fact that wonderful musical Hamilton is so popular amongst young people now. They know this time period. The second act of Lin-Manuel's marvelous musical, Hamilton, is exactly our time period. We share some of the same characters. And there are legions of young people out there now who really actually know this history. I think it's going to be very exciting. Gunpowder Joe is not a hip-hop musical. However, Steve Gilliland is a hip-hop musician, and there are hip-hop beats in it. He's doing beatboxing. It's going to be very recognizable, lively, and it will feel up-to-date.
When can we come and see Gunpowder Joe?
Well, our first preview is January 19th, and it runs through February 5th. In addition to our performances for our regular audience, we're also having high school matinees for area schools. Information about all of this can be found on our website, bte.org. It's going to be surprising.
Director Laurie McCants, a co-founding member of the Bloomsburg Theatre Ensemble, speaking with WVIA's Fiona Powell about the world premiere of Gunpowder Joe. This is a brand new play that was commissioned by and coordinated with the Bloomsburg Theatre Ensemble from the award-winning playwright Anthony Carveau. Gunpowder Joe, Joseph Priestley, Pennsylvania, and The American Experiment, directed by Laurie McCants, January 19th through February 5th, with evening performances as well as Project Discovery student matinees. A world premiere, and that's a production by the Bloomsburg Theatre Ensemble, presenting a work by award-winning playwright Anthony Clairvaux, commissioned by and created with the Bloomsburg Theatre Ensemble, about Joseph Priestley, celebrated scientist, radical religious leader, and fierce defender of the American Revolution, who, after making himself the most hated man in England, spent his last years here in our area in Northumberland, Pennsylvania. For more information, on the web, bte.org, bte.org. There will be public performances Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m., Sundays at 3 at the Alvina Krauss Theater in downtown Bloomsburg. BTE's traditional Pay What You Wish preview performances are January 19th and 20th at 7:30, and Pay What You Decide opening night is Saturday, January 21st at 7:30 p.m. For more information, on the web, bte.org, bte.org. Many thanks, Fiona Powell, and thanks, Laurie McCants.